company who's currently here this morning. And just say that my name's Claire McDonald. I'm director of ICFRA, the International Centre for Fine Art Research. And but the day has been put together by Steve Wall of the British Artists Film and Video Study Collection, because ICFRA with BAFSVC, as we call them colloquially, is really starting to think about archives. And we wanted to have a kind of invited room for what's been, I think, rather formally called a study day, to have a kind of conversation with colleagues in and outside UAL, some of whom are already working on projects with us and some of whom are not, to think about how we might share a kind of intellectually informed and practical approach to some of the ways in which we might develop archival practices as part of research, artist-centred, but not, but artists in collaboration with scholars, curators, and archivists. And that's really why we're here. And I think what we expect to get out of today is to think about a kind of connectivity, in a sense that mirrors some of the things that we've already been talking about in the kind of online world, the ways in which what Steve often calls kind of migrating archives, the current ways in which we do connect with one another, in which the opportunities for sharing, collaboration, and for the use and reuse of materials has changed. Really, I began at ICFRA in September, and I almost feel as if things have changed quite profoundly even since September, in the 6 months that I've been here. So this is actually at a very opportune moment. Of course, it also takes place at a moment when the institution itself, and it's rather more kind of corporate mode, is thinking about the repository. It's a word, I have
terrible word.
I find it's really hard to say without...
You're not alone in that.
And so the kind of, not exactly the conflict, but the dialogue, if you like, between ideas about preservation and ideas about, I think, what Sue Brakel has called something like, you know, the archive is a dynamic site for generation and reuse, is really going on. So it's a kind of intimate conversation, if you like, one in which we've all, I think, got stakes, if you like, as one way to put that. So we're looking today at what we might generate. Its context, its frame is research. And we, as well, I think, are developing, I hope, a kind of collaborative ethic. So that although we're often in both kind of internal and external competitive situations, we're actually much more interested in how it is we share and collaborate these days. And that's a kind of really important starting point, I think, today. So the way in which the day is going to run is that Steve Ball is going to talk in a fantastical and hypothetical way about archives initially. And then Campbell from Lux Online, or from Lux, who works Lux on, manages Lux Online, is going to talk, I think, in a less fantastical way about the ways in which practically and sort of conceptually that project works. And then there are a few other people who kind of join us during the day. Now, as I said, my role is purely kind of mediatory. And I felt that one of the things that I might do initially is just to say, okay, well, we should introduce ourselves as to who's in the room this morning and perhaps what our interests are in working with UAL, but also in the practices of archival research and curation. My personal interest, in fact, is that I'm also involved in a sound project at the moment, a project which is dealing with the nature of the acoustic and the vocal through the oral history of performance. So, although I don't come to this through moving image, I've got other interests in it as well. Steve and Campbell, they'll introduce themselves as they present. But perhaps we would like to, I think I know who most people are, but let's just go around and just say a couple of things about yourselves as our next introduction.
Well, morning, everybody. My name's Nigel Llewellyn. I'm head of research at Tate. And I'm here to represent a number of us at Tate who've got interests in archives and in these issues that have already been raised. My own background is, however, one which uses archives in particular ways, in that I'm an art historian by training and I work on old stuff. So in the past I tended to use archives in that rather orthodox repository way, things which are static, where you know what the numbers mean, where you can get bits of paper out and use them for other purposes. But Tate's interest in this kind of work is, I hope, fairly obvious. You mentioned Sue Brecker a moment ago, who heads our archive. We're very well aware that we've got the most extraordinary resource at Tate in that archive, and are very interested in any ideas about how to exploit its potential.
And I think, as far as I understand, you're already working with UAL on the project on the John Latham materials as well, although there's an application.
Yes, what's happened there is that one element within the archive is a body of material relating to the artist placement group, acquired fairly recently, and we submitted an application to the AHRC a few months ago to do some work on that. I could talk about that a bit later on, if that would be useful, because it's actually quite interesting.
Yeah,
testing
the
water.
It is a very interesting project. I'll talk to Neil White about it.
Good.
Thanks very much. Felicity.
Felicity Sparrow, I'm actually a research student here. I have, for many years, been a user of archives, but I mean, film archives in particular, and have also, from using archives not just in this country but in other countries, have brought films by early women directors back into distribution through that, which is partly what my studies are about here. I'm also someone who directly and indirectly contributes to archives in that Tate. We've just spoken about the Tate Archive. My husband, Ian Brakewell, has an archive there, and I'm quite, as a lot of people are approaching me for Ian's archive, I'm finding it quite difficult to manage, not in terms of his personal archive, which went to Tate, but the people who are approaching me wanting to hold his films. And so I'm very wary of the National Film Archive, because I'm not sure that that is the repository for artists' work. But on the other hand, I'm also wary of Tate, because I don't think they have the expertise to look after films. And I think this is a growing area of concern for those who are wanting, whether it's their own work, their partner's work, their mother's work, their children's work, wanting to preserve moving image material and how best to do it.
That is very succinct about that relationship between ownership, preservation and change.
Hello, I'm Molly Taylor, and I work for Isaac Julian, who's an artist filmmaker. Isaac's been looking at his archive for the last year or so, and deciding really what he's going to do with it, and we're trying to get it into the right conditions at the moment. We've been talking to various archives around the country. We're lucky enough to have just taken on a space temporarily in King's Cross, so we actually have the space for the first time to get the archive out and look at it and find out what's there. We started to log all of that. And so really I'm quite new to the whole concept of archives, so I wanted to come along today just to meet some other people and hopefully pick up some ideas and take those back to Isaac so we can decide what to do practically with his. I mean, he worked with archiving quite a lot on various films. He's just done a film about Derek Jarman, and that very much brought those sort of issues to light. And so he just decided that, you know, while he's around and he's able, he wanted to do something with his archive himself before, you know, it was too late, and, you know, it was taken out of his hands, as it were.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Okay. I'm Pat Christie. I'm the director of Library and Known Resources here. I fear I'm regarded as the corporate voice. That's one of the things I want to do, is to kind of really talk about how LLR taps into many of the things I've already just said. Also to say that I think we have to resolve some of those tensions, I think, and we are very committed to resolving some of those tensions between the anxieties around over-institutionalising things and what that might mean for the individual artist. In terms of LLR, I mean, we have many ways we relate to this. I mean, one, we do have, and we are responsible for, a range of static archives, the traditional archives. We have the University Archives and Special Collections Centre, which the main collection within that is the Stanley Kubrick archive, which is a ginormous resource that I think many of you are very aware of. We also are very interested in digitisation, and one of the things that we're involved with, and Andrew will talk a lot more about this, is an institutional repository project with the University of Southampton, UCA, and BADS, looking at a wide range of issues that have been concerning the creative arts community about institutional repositories, which is why, in a way, they haven't gone into that territory. And we want to address those issues and really find solutions that will be of the benefit, not actually just to the academic creative arts community, but actually also potentially cross-sectoral as well, as you think about museums and galleries and so on. So that's a very exciting project that I think will probably have a number of the answers to some of your more technical issues.
Yeah.
And I do think that actually there's a great potential for collaboration here in terms of, and from that point of view, resolving those tensions about corporate, because actually I think we could work really well together. Because obviously our whole raison d'etre is obviously to encourage new research, to be responsible for kind of storing research, but also making it accessible and generating new research, not just research on the kind of theoretical basis, but new creative works. And indeed, one of the things that's happening, I was just saying to Molly with the Stanley Kubrick Archive, is that the Wilson twins are actually doing a response to that archive. And I think that's exactly the kind of thing we want to be doing in terms of how to make archives feed into the future. So we have that kind of interest. The other thing also, just to tap into where I may be useful to you over time, is that I attended a meeting recently at Bush Library with RIN, Research Information Network, AHRC, Royal College of Art, Goldsmiths, I think that was it, where again we're talking about this very much not as an individual institution issue but as a community issue, you know, and some of the things that came out as big issues was actually things like knowledge issues around knowledge transfer partnerships, so how a creative arts archive feeds into other sectors, the commercial sectors and so on, but also very much about, I'm going back to what you said, that word institutional repository is just so wrong. It sends out such the wrong message, but actually, because what we're saying, you know, for creative arts in particular, you want something very living, very active, and very, you know, you want something far more buzzy as a term, so how to deal with some of those issues. But the proposal there is that there'll be a workshop later on that will bring in a range of people that will actually talk about that and really think about probably the next steps, blue skies thinking, building on and beyond the culture project, which was seen as a kind of key cornerstone for this area. I've probably rambled on enough now, so I shall stop and move on to the next person, maybe.
I'm Martin Cannon from the Slade School. I'm here today on behalf of Susan Collins and John Thompson and the Slade Centre for Electronic Media. For the past 15 years, we've had an informal collection of students' work, both on a web server and it's are now on various formats, and it's just stored in lots of boxes and different cupboards. We're trying to work out what we should do with it and how we should handle it, and that's why today was of interest.
I'm Andrew Gray, as Pat has pointed out. I'm a culture project officer. Main thing to, I think, to add to what Pat has expanded on about culture is, again, the word institutional repository, horrible, but I mean, it's come out of different university communities, different academic communities, and I think that's the main point to remember, is that the actual communities that have actually created it for themselves. So culture is looking at the arts community, so what it wants to be is the researchers within the arts community to actually create the repository, to decide what actually goes in there, how it should work for them, rather than it being the actual institution, the university itself. So obviously again it's come out of the open source community. The whole point is to be sharing and reusing material. So I think focusing on it as an institutional thing is probably maybe a bit too misleading. We want to move it more over to the actual people who are going to be putting material in and who are going to be using it. And I think also the culture project is just examining really what repositories or IRs, I prefer, can actually do and what they actually need to change, how they need to change to serve different communities. and obviously again feeding back into just the wider academic, wider museum communities, etc. So I think it's a really exciting area, and obviously within our short time period we're not going to be able to resolve everything, but I think hopefully we can make a few advances, to a few pointers, and something like this will be a great contribution so we can actually steer it a lot better.
I'm Adam Lockhart. I work for Rewind Archive, which is based at the University of Dundee. We are collecting artists' video and we are preserving it for long term for the future. We're collecting documentation from artists as well, and we are disseminating it and re-examining works and re-editing them back to simulations of original multi-screen works and installations and things like that. But the important thing is we're working with the artists, we're working sensitively with them, and we're doing it so it's done right, and we're making sure that this work is going to be preserved in the future. We've got an agreement with the Scottish Screen Archive, we're going to store all the work in the correct conditions and they'll be responsible for the future migration of it onto the new formats. We're only dealing with artists' video, not film, because of the sort of ephemeral nature of video. Film's got more sort of life to it. But I'm also working on David Curtis's project to do with narrative and expanded cinema, which is just starting up. And I've also got connections to the Richard DeMarco Photography Archive, which is based at the University of Dundee as well, which is to digitise 20,000 of his photographs and store them on a digital archive.
I'm David Curtis. I work with Stephen, who's going to talk about the study collection, which is our base, really. I suppose my role there has been, in a sense, to kind of start the collecting process. I used to work at the Arts Council and was very much aware in the years that I worked there that there was nobody collecting the ephemera, the art objects themselves in the moving image area. It somehow always fell between the responsibility of the Arts Council and the BFI. I think, I mean, in the last few years, the BFI has started to address that in a kind of slow way, but still I'd say the majority of moving image works made in the last 80 years don't reside in any archive. They reside in the artists' attics, garages, wherever. So the drive to try and pull that material in, partly through projects like the Rewind Project and so on, partly through the work that Lux has been doing, but also through the work we're doing, I think is very important. So I think my role at the study collection has basically been to try and bring the work in, though because it's such a kind of invisible area, or historically has been, the whole question of how you make it visible, how you give it a kind of public presence, is obviously equally important, and we've been working on that. And I think Stephen will talk about some of the ways in which we have tried to make the collection and the whole area more visible. That'll do, because Stephen will pick up.
Well, that's great. I'm going to Campbell and Steve will just introduce themselves as they then do their pieces. But already that sets up numbers of different kinds of rolling lists or agendas that I think we would all recognise parts of, and sort of major areas of discussion about the relationship between preservation and generation, how research is intellectually informed, what the practical needs and of users are, and what words like past and future mean in some complex way as well. And I think we'll just come back to those after we've had these two presentations. We'll have a kind of informal discussion about the kinds of issues that arise. And we'll begin to take things on from there. And we have a slight issue this afternoon that we've got, we have a fellow here, Pete Cornwell, who works in both industry and the Innovation Centre, who's working with us on archives at the moment. And we're not sure if Pete is going to do a presentation because he has some American clients. So we're either going to have Pete or someone from his studio.
Yes.
So we'll, after our discussion this morning, we'll have a break and then we'll return to some of those issues this afternoon. But really the most important thing is to curate this conversation amongst ourselves. And in order to start to begin to develop that, I'd like to invite Steve to make the first presentation. And then we'll move straight on to Campbell's presentation and then we'll talk.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Yes, as David said, I've been working with him at the British Artist Film and Video Study Collection as a research fellow. And part of the my role there has been to assist in a way of making the work visible by doing things like building databases that provide information about the work. We've had curated online exhibitions which have made visible some of the contents of the study collection as a way of... But one thing that we have actually avoided doing so far, and we may continue to avoid doing that at the moment and for the foreseeable future, I'm not sure, is to actually make the study collection available online as a resource in the same way that a number of other collections and archives are available online. We've sort of really been more concerned with encouraging people to come into the study collection and look at materials there. So it's very much still a kind of analog approach to collecting. In a sense, the impetus for putting this day together has been around one of the things that we are doing, and I'm doing with as a collaborative project with ICFAR, is to develop this idea of an archive as a potential research project, and the research project is also based around the fact that we are building a facility which we're hoping, and it depends very much on how the hardware and software works and how that interfaces and so on, will be a kind of what I would describe as a kind of multi-stream facility. I'm thinking that there is the potential there to interrogate a number of different archives simultaneously. So my presentation is really going to be a kind of speculative, in a way kind of fantastical idea about what that might mean for the methodology of researchers researching multiple archives. Coming from the point of view of somebody who works a lot with artist moving image material, so it's kind of based on that, but also not restricted to that. I'll go more into that in my presentation. So this is really a way of thinking of it from the point of view methodologically of the practice-based researcher in terms of the way they interrogate archives, and perhaps the way that artist practice might then feed back into archives or collections. I kind of also along the way try and explore and explode the notion of what is an archive. So in a sense I'm kind of shifting the definition away from the notion of an institutional repository, a place for preservation and sustainability, but sort of being a lot more promiscuous perhaps about what we think of as archives and the way they might be used. Anyway, that hopefully will come out of the presentation. The presentation might be a little bit rambling. I haven't really kind of rehearsed it and tried it out, so bear with me. There's a lot of moving image material in it, so even if I don't make any sense, you can kind of sit back and enjoy the enjoy the pictures. If somebody could just turn the front lights out here, it's the right-hand switch, David, then at least the projection will look slightly better. I thought, just as a way of kind of introducing... just as a way of starting into introducing this, I was going to show a video, which kind of encapsulates some of some of the ideas that I'm talking about in some ways that I'll be expanding on. So this is the remote controller by people like us, and I'll talk about it a bit afterwards, but I thought it might be nice just to start with a film. If it will work.
It's in the hills and the bright blue sky. It's in the quiet lakes with their soft horizons. It's in the fields of ripened grain. It's in the clear early morning. It's in the late afternoon. It's in unexpected places with sudden bright surprises. Found in new things. It is a harp string of beauty, the keyboard of mood. Through the dark ages, the problem is how to create order out of confusion, how to achieve something harmonious, creatively and scientifically new. Mixing is so simple, a child can do it. The result is breathtaking beauty and lasting good taste. In lovely homes and simple dwellings throughout the length and breadth of the land,
strings, or rather by having somebody else pull the strings for them. All these motions are the work of the artist who manipulates the control stick. A twist of the wrist, tension on the string, a crook of the finger or gentle swerve of the arm, and our gay figures perform cleverly for the delight of beholders. The puppeteer can endow his character with surprisingly lifelike motions. Through the movement of his hands, he gives his wooden mannequins all the characteristics of living, breathing persons. By remote control, the puppeteer puts his characters through any desired action. There is, of course, the necessity for close study of action in real life so that it can be truthfully interpreted. Then, with what seems to be a minimum of finger and arm movement, the control stick is twisted, turned, and bobbed. The strings actuate the puppets, and we see a remarkable, natural portrayal of life. This is a form of remote control that brings much pleasure in the entertainment field. the hands of the puppeteer send signals of action to actors on the stage. And it's strictly a one-man show. Some of the most amazing theatrical effects brought about by remote control take place on stages in modern theaters. Audiences in these theaters witness instantaneous changes of elaborate spectacles as huge stage settings rise or disappear at unpredictable moments. Actually, the stage is a series of elevators that are controlled from the switchboard. Pushing one of these buttons is the only physical labor connected with moving the stage elevators. Then pressure goes to work, pushing up huge platforms which make up the stage. The control system is so elaborate, yet functions so easily and swiftly, that amazing scenic changes are possible during a very short blackout. Through the magic of remote control, all things become possible to the men who plan and design spectacles for the modern theater. Every form of showmanship is utilized on stages where the mere pushing of a button creates magical effects for an audience, effects that add novelty and beauty to artistic settings. Even more dramatic in these days of increased production, when our nation's industrial centers must be tied even more closely together. An unseen hand moves in a tower miles away. A switch clicks. A signal is displayed. No unnecessary stops. Operators sit in control rooms and watch illuminated diagrams by pushing a button that sets switches 100 miles away without leaving his position. Tailored for your needs of today and tomorrow, bringing together all people in a new era of understanding. Pick a city, dial the area code, presto, instant weather. Turning light into electricity to run this display. Solar batteries are used to convert sunlight to electrical power and make our satellites talk back from outer space. Like the gentle twist of a puppet string or the push of a button that sets tons of stage into motion, with a slight flip of a finger on a lever. This work doesn't even require separate motors, while the driver retains just enough of the control to be the real boss at all times. In no other application does the use of remote control benefit us so much. Ours is merely the light task of remote control. Remote control is a big factor in modern living. Yet, because it is a development intended to save us from unnecessary work, it is something we know very little about. In fact, we do very little. Merely push a button and let something else do the work for us.
So, I thought I'd just let that sit there for a while. So that was Remote Controller by People Like Us, which is a woman called Vicky Bennett. And you'll notice that in the credits it said that the material came from the Prelinger archives. So for people who are not familiar with Rick Prelinger and his work, I'll just give a bit of an outline. In the mid-90s, the American media archaeologist Rick Prelinger produced Our Secret Century, which was a series of interactive CD-ROMs. They conducted a kind of guided tour through his archive of industrial, educational, and propaganda films. and they revealed what he described as the hidden history of the American 20th century. Boom-busting from consumerism to the Depression, from social guidance, family values, propaganda to health and safety issues, it is by turns disturbing, funny, revealing, and rather camp. Preminger deposited the bulk of his archive with the National Library of Congress, and the public domain material is now accessible from the Internet Archive, and it's downloadable as full-frame, full-motion MPEG video files. One of the primary sources of the material used by Vicky Bennett in her People Like Us videos is the Preminger Archive. The files are downloaded and then combined, layered into collages. To all intents and purposes, this is found footage, but her work has little in common, I would suggest, with the conventions of the use of found footage in a lot of avant-garde film. In many ways, it's much more of a kind of extension of the sampledelic sonic appropriation collage used by musicians, often typified by hip-hop, and with a nod to the hacker sensibility of plunderphonics. Preminger's analysis in Our Secret Century was underscored by obsessions of a conspiracy theorist. Bennett's use, I would say, is kind of more complex, sometimes almost celebratory, reveling in the nostalgic gloss and the retro patina of the archival material, but with a knowing sideways glance at the process and practices of production and the source of the material. So that's just a little bit that I've about that work. I think while I'm talking, I'll show something in the background, because otherwise it could take forever. This is a film by Derek Boucher called Link, which was made in 1971. A lot of the thinking that has kind of coalesced around this presentation was inspired a little bit by a presentation I saw Patricia Zimmerman do late last year at a conference in Sunderland. And there's a little handout that's going around with some text, which is kind of like an abstract for this presentation in a way, and sort of frames the thinking. One of her statements was to say that archival objects are not static, but provisional and fluid. They can be mobilized to create a collaborative, performative space for the imagination of new histories, new futures, and new works. I would suggest that within a few years, the contemporary notion of the archive has shifted away from being a static repository for historical artifacts, and in combination with hypertextual links, meta-tagging, is being reconfigured as a dynamic collection of searchable materials. The web has been instrumental in developing and popularizing new paradigms for research, and with the likes of YouTube, Preminger's Internet Archive, Google Video, alongside more specialised collections such as Ubu Web and Lux Online, moving image and sound material has joined text and image in the repertoire of media readily available online. Within the artist film and video study collection, we've always stressed the fact that we're not an archive, in the sense that we're not archivists in the kind of traditional sense, so we're not in the business of collecting original master copies or unique objects, and the materials, you know, we don't have to handle materials with white gloves and so on. In spite of the fact that we do have examples of that those kind of items, often by kind of accident, and we're more like a reference library. In the context of the sort of digital online archives and collections that I'm kind of redefining perhaps here, we are an archive. A collection is as much an archive as anything else in this sense. The experience of searching the web and other more specialized and structured databases often has one skipping from and between all manner of media, and often through happenstance finding lateral relationships between subject and material, producing hybrid forms and methodologies of research. Conventional research practices tend to shy away from such promiscuity, encouraging the researcher rather to focus on specifics and research a small range of questions and material in depth, in inverted commas, and in linear progression often. Nicolas Bourriaud writes in post-production, "To rewrite modernity is the historical task of this early 21st century. not to start at zero or find oneself encumbered by the storehouse of history, but to inventory and select, to use and to download, and I might add to that, and also to upload. The point of showing Link by Derek Boucher is really to introduce a whole little series of kind of experiments I'm doing here in a way. Link, which is, it's, as you can see, if you've been watching it, is composed mainly of found footage from advertising, science, instructional, and mainstream films, juxtaposed with animated objects, related by their structure, the structural form, cubes, domes, and something that he calls pyramoids, which I presume mean kind of solid pyramid shapes, and linked together showing some of the man-made and natural manifestations of the basic forms. That's from the, I think that came from the Lux program, though. So essentially, the film relies on the temporal succession of visual clusters. Its editing is kind of interesting. It makes its point in terms of the way these shapes relate to each other. I think sometimes the relationships and the materials used are kind of a little bit naive and perhaps slightly simplistic, but it works in its way. In the sense that I think it stands as an interesting example of a kind of pattern recognition, if you like. It's a kind of an abstraction of archives and made of scraps of found footage. So I've been thinking about how we might cluster images in terms of this kind of associative way, abstract association of abstract data, shape, colour, circular shapes, spherical shapes, and so on. And I'll just stop that for a second. Another film, which is kind of even more abstract and earlier than this, that I've always been rather fond of, is a film by John Latham, which I'm not sure how many people are familiar with this, so I'll show it. So this is Speak, which was made in 1962. Ray Dergnat said of this film that not since Len Lye's films in the 30s has England produced such a brilliant example of animated abstraction. Speak burns its way directly into the brain. It is one of the few films about which it can truly be said it will live in your mind. Whether or not that's actually the case, perhaps in 1962... But what I was interested in terms of this is the fact that it largely consists of disc forms and shapes. And I was kind of interested in the experiment of perhaps putting Link together with Derek Boucher's Link together with John Latham's Speak. And to kind of start to get an idea of what might happen once you start thinking of looking at this material spatially, so one beside each other, and kind of making more spatial connections. And I was thinking of all these choices are kind of slightly random, based mainly on these kind of formal connections between the films, but there's another film, a video in fact, by Mineo Iyamaguchi, which I'll put on now, called Primary Contrasting Elements, which again uses the disc shape and colours, and it's basically a kind of abstract exploration of the symbolic relationship between primary forms, the circle, the square, and the triangle, and as you can see, that they sit central to the frame. So I kind of thought, well, that's interesting. Let's see what happens if we perhaps add that to the mix. So now we've got primary contrasting elements with Link and Speak. And I mean, this has been a slightly random position that I've started up with these two, but already you can kind of see what I think is kind of an interesting abstract association not just within each work, but between each work. And I'm kind of interested in the way that this, you know, this might open up ways of approaching work and reading new work. Another film that by Guy Sherwin is a film called called Cycles, made in 1972, which is a flicker film, essentially, where he investigates rhythms of light and sound near to the persistence of vision and sound thresholds. And the film's made by punching holes into plain leader. So, again, we've got this kind of recurring disc shape. So, you know, I'm thinking, what happens if we put that beside primary contrasting elements and we start to see a kind of dialogue going on, abstract dialogue going on between those two pieces. And then I started thinking about other works that use similar kind of forms, albeit still kind of abstractly. And I was thinking about this piece here. A bit of techno to the mix. So now we have primary contrasting elements on the left, Guy Sherwin's Cycles on the right, and in the middle, Eurotechno, which is by Stacker, a 1988 video, computer-generated video. So here I'm making connections very much based on shape, formal connections, and I was kind of thinking that these are the sort of connections that perhaps image data recognition software might start to make if it were investigating a collection or archive of digital material. And what might be interesting about starting to look at these in a kind of more dynamic spatial way. Combining three works which might not otherwise be associated with each other from different orientations. We've got, you know, a materialist film made with a hole punch. We've got a colourful, abstract video animation and what can best be described as an early techno-computer-generated rave video, which has a lot of centred, rotated and shinily rendered shapes, which were kind of state-of-the-art for when it was made in 1988. I'll just give you a little flavour of that. If anybody feels like dancing, why wouldn't they? Anyway, I'll turn the sound down a bit. As I was watching this again for the first time since about 1988, I realised that it also has, every so often you'll see little fleeting snippets of text, kind of abstract code embedded in the animation, in the abstract animation. There's a few there. This kind of suggested to me a sort of time-based digital concrete poetry in a way. And I was reminded of the Sackner Archive of Concrete and Visual Poetry, which is a resource, an archive that's available on the web. Ruth and Marvin Sackner, they founded the archive in Miami Beach. I'll just turn the volume down a little bit. Founded the archive in Miami Beach, Florida in 1979. And its initial mission was to collect, to establish a collection of books, critical texts, periodicals, ephemera, prints, drawings, collages, paintings, sculptures, objects, manuscripts, and correspondence, it says here, dealing with contemporary internationally produced concrete and visual poetry. So essentially it's images of these, and I'll show you a couple in a minute. And most, I'm not sure if all of it, but most of their collection is viewable on the archive's website, and if anybody's interested, I can give you the URL for that. So I was kind of thinking of ways of maybe, let's have a look at this, see how this works. This is, what I've done here is to slow down Stacker on the left with the Eurotechno and to animate some of the material from the SACNA archive on the right. I've deliberately chosen works of concrete poetry that maintain this kind of centrally located disc kind of form, just in a sense as by way of illustration as much as anything. So I'm sort of spatially juxtaposing and animating material from in these from both our own collections, the study collection, and other material from specialised web-based archives. I'm thinking of the way that this we might be able to start tracing possible cross-disciplinary and generic coincidences here, excavating perhaps alternative histories. So in this kind of little slideshow of concrete poetry and slowed down technical video, I think there are kind of abstract visual similarities there. This is one of the pieces that was in that little spatial collage, and there's also a lot of work by this is a piece by Bob Cobbing, who was one of the early founder members of the London Filmmakers Co-op, but also a visual and concrete and performing poet, and he made a piece here called Movie Book, which was basically visual concrete poetry, which he would also describe as a film. We have a form such as concrete poetry where the work is quite iconographic. It's more important not so much as reading as text, but as an image. Which are kind of described as a sort of synesthesia of remediation. And in a sense, that's kind of what that is. What I wanted to jump to now was to talk a little bit about A.B. Warburg, which a few people presumably are familiar with A.B. Warburg and the A.B. Warburg Institute. Warburg was born in Hamburg in 1866, and he studied the history of art in Bonn, Florence, and Strasbourg before graduating with a doctoral thesis on Botticelli's mythologies. He became increasingly to feel the limitations of a predominantly stylistic approach to the history of art and sought contact with the emerging Kulturwissenschaft, excuse my German, which roughly translates as culture science, of the anthropologists. He conceived the program of illustrating the process by which the memory of the past affects a culture. The paradigm he chose was the influence of antiquity on modern European civilization in all its aspects, social, political, religious, scientific, philosophical, literary, and artistic, and he ordered his private library in Hamburg accordingly. After escaping the... Actually, let's get on to Warburg's... These are some... After escaping Nazism, he moved the Institute to London, and in 1944 the Institute was incorporated in the University of London, where it is now a close neighbour to the Slade College. But I think the significance of Warburg to my kind of thinking about this today is with his Mnemosyne Atlas, which these are examples of Warburg's Mnemosyne. It's fundamentally an attempt to combine a philosophical and image historical approach. You can see in some of these photographs attached on wooden boards covered in black cloth are photographs of images, reproductions from books and visual materials from newspapers and or daily life, which Warburg arranged in such a way that they illustrate one or several thematic areas. Today, his visual style of working could be categorised as visual clusters, in a sense very much like the Derek Boschier film we saw earlier. Only these are not necessarily ordered to visual similarity, evident, but in a kind of iconographical history of style, but through relationships caused by an affinity for one another and the principle of good company. A.B. Warburg's Mnemosyne is is credited with activating the excavation of movement in the image by spatializing readings across multiple images in juxtaposition, producing an iconic knowledge movement of images. And for more of this, it's worth reading a book by Philippe Alain Michaud called A.B. Warburg and the Image in Motion. He worked across a number of cultural fields, from multiple paintings of figures, which suggest an almost Duchampian depiction of nude descending style movement, in Botticelli's paintings of the Graces in Spring, to photographing the complexities of Native American Sioux dances. He thought of his work as much, perhaps more, as a work of composition and reproduction as the work of history and ethnography, which might be more categorized of conventionally. So I kind of been thinking what the potential might be of expanding this kind of process into the spatial juxtaposition of materials sourced from a range of different specialized archives across a range of media such as moving image, still image, text, and sound. The experience of the spatial is one of happenstance, of the surprise encounter, and such an inquiry would work against linear progression and teleological development and towards a much more naturalistic approach where meaning is developed through hitherto unexpected encounter and elaboration. It's not terribly good quality because I downloaded this from YouTube, but the reason for including it was because a little while ago in a conversation I was having with Claire, we both talked briefly about a number of artist films and videos that were made, I guess, around sort of from the mid-80s to the mid-90s or so, which for whatever reasons feature swimming pools in them or are set in a swimming pool. And then I thought about this idea of the association of the disc shape, and immediately thought of Busby Berkeley and swimming pools. But also thought of films. I'll let this little thing finish, it's fine. Sorry, that's where we ended. And I was thinking about films like Tina Keane's Neon Diver, which I'll show a little clip from here. And I've chosen to start this at a point where there is a visual similarity to Busby Berkeley, although I understand that she's kind of more interested in Esther Williams and synchronized films. So, this is a nice song. So Tina says about her film that it's the pool in the film is a metaphor for identity, pleasure, and voyeurism. Swimmers walk around the edge of the pool, define the frame, and diving one by one, self-possessed and in control of their bodies. As they cross and recross the water, they convey purposeful action and hedonism. They parody the frolics of Esther Williams and the synchronized swimmers who flicker on the surface. There should be some soon. Of the water, somersaulting and forming rosettes. They expose playfulness as a vehicle for submerged voyeurism. These scenes are ritualistically punctuated by images of a diver and a punk violinist. They repeatedly challenge our perceptions beneath and above the illusory surface to proclaim an identity free from constraints. Another film that spends a lot of its time in the swimming pool is Crystal Aquarium by Jane Parker. And here you can see the apple is being peeled underwater. And another kind of interestingly circular form happening there. Spiral in this case, I guess. And another film a little earlier by Tony Hill called Waterwork, which consists of images shot at and just below the surface of a swimming pool. So I was kind of interested to continue my multi-screen experiment, putting these three together. So from left to right we have Tina Keane's Neon Diver, Tony Hill's Waterwork, and Jane Parker's Crystal Aquarium there on the right. One thing that I did think about doing with this was there are sequences in Tina Keane's film with the violinist, and there are sections in Crystal Aquarium with a drummer, and I did have this idea of creating a kind of little musical section here, but I avoided that because we're going to come to musical ensembles a bit later. And I have kind of juxtaposed them fairly arbitrarily, but you do see some interesting kind of visual sort of polynarratives going on just from this sort of very much kind of random happenstance approach to putting these works together. So as I say, most of this material so far has been work that is held in the study collection here, our study collection. But I decided to kind of go out in the big wide world of the web and to see what other swimming pool videos I could find. And so I went to YouTube. And what I kind of found interesting was people do video their kids in swimming pools. which is actually what Tony Hill was doing with his work. I mean, a lot of the people in Tony Hill's film are members of his family and friends and so on. So this is a kind of contemporary, in a sense, amateur, if you like, equivalent of what Tony Hill was doing. So I thought it might be quite interesting to juxtapose those as well. And the one on the right is another video by somebody called Bikini Girl. You know Bikini Girl, yes. That's why she came up high on the list when I did a search for swimming pools, yes. So I was kind of thinking about this in a sense from the point of view of researching, a kind of multi-screen research into this material, the different types of collections that one might be able to juxtapose and to start reading kind of spatially. And collections archives, if you like YouTube. I think YouTube has become partly a kind of folk archive, which is common to a lot of what we might call user-generated content sites and social networking and so on. But I think beyond simply looking at this as a phenomenon of Web 2.0, these are accessible archive resources that go beyond subject and discipline specialization. And I think they're useful for both practice and research purposes in terms of researching the material. And kind of, in a sense, I feel kind of highlight the paradox of the notion of the digital archive, because the digital suggests something transient and rhizomic, perhaps, and the archive suggests something more, with more permanent roots and permanent. So this digital archive is a kind of paradoxical idea. And excuse me for using Deleuzean metaphors there, arboreal metaphors. So perhaps, it demands a kind of reappraisal, like Patricia Zinnemann does with the notion of the migratory archive. It's not unified. It is, as she says, polyversal, polyphonic, and polyvocal. The other thing I found in my searches was this, which I just kind of somehow brings all those things together. Yeah, this is something that's kind of happening in advertising now as well. Which sort of suggested to me that perhaps there is a potential research project in all of this.
The big ego.
Just in swimming pool. But the point really is that I'm thinking in terms of multi-screen as a way into collections and into works themselves as well. Spatial research and writing. I mean, we're familiar with the idea of multi-screen reading in terms of expanded cinema. And installation works. And I did another little experiment with thinking about notions of associative visual clusters and just as a little experiment, see what would happen if we try to so-called spatialize individual works. There's a piece by an artist called Paul Bush called Rumor of True Things, and it's made pretty much entirely of found material, and they move through a kind of number of zones of types of images from what we might describe as the military and industrial complex. And I thought, well, what happens? Here's, well, here's just a little bit of it. I'll just move it on a bit so one can get just a flavour of the kind of material he uses. And it becomes a kind of an associative montage that develops in a temporal sense. It's a linear piece. It has a beginning and an end. At this point, we're looking at sort of microscopic organisms and so on, and I'm just doing this very randomly. There isn't really time to watch the whole thing, but it's a kind of visual analysis material he's using. I wonder what it would be like to kind of take, basically split the work in three. And I've used the sort of the triptych formation as a convenience. I could have gone up to four or five, but because of the resolution of this screen, these screens, it might have become a little bit too unreadable. And so I split Rumour of True Things into three parts. To start thinking of the way that, you know, we are familiar with the idea of multi-screen installation, but then splitting a work up in this way, in interrupting its temporality and spatializing it, becomes another way of reading a work, another way perhaps of investigating what is happening within the work. In the way that connections are made across a work within it. While I was thinking about this, I was thinking of other examples of works that have an interesting kind of way of using multi-screens. And I was thinking about Haran Feroki's Deep Play, which for me, in spite of the fact that I'm not much of a football fan, was one of the highlights of the last documenta. What Feroki does with Deep Play is to... over 12 screens, he presents 12 different perspectives of one of the biggest broadcasting events ever, which was the 2006 World Cup final held in Germany. And the screens combine the artist's own footage, the footage from FIFA, digital analysis, 2 and 3D animation sequence, so that we see the event from a number of viewpoints. And when you see the installation, one of the remarkable things about it is that the 12 screens are entirely synchronized, so that on each screen you're at exactly the same point in the play of the football match, and you see different types of analysis of the match, but simultaneously. So it's whatever. I can't remember whether it went into extra play. Somebody like Adam would know more about football than I do, but it's at least 90 minutes long. It's probably longer than that, about two hours or so. I tried to look for documentation of it, and found something on YouTube and tried this sort of spatialization experiment using the stuff I downloaded from YouTube. But of course, it ruins the piece because it disrupts and completely breaks up what is kind of remarkable about Faraci's piece, which is the level of synchronization between multi-screens. So in this case, it was a lot less satisfactory. This recreates a work that kind of undermines the you know, what was essentially interesting about the piece in the first place. I'm aware that I'm going on for a while, so I'm just going to skip a little bit and come to my last piece, which is Christian Marclay's Video Quartet. Now, Video Quartet, for those people who haven't seen it, Marclay, who kind of similar to Vicky Bennett and people like us who we started with, kind of comes from that sort of sampledelic, plunderphonic background, primarily coming from work in sound and music and expanding much more into moving image work. In Video Quartet, he took an enormous number of short clips from mostly kind of Hollywood movies, which and documentaries of things like Woodstock, but each clip features a musician playing the musical instrument, and over four screens he creates a new quartet out of each of these snippets, and it's an incredibly kind of sophisticated interplay. It becomes a musical piece, a musical visual piece in itself. Of course, the only documentation I could find of this was, again, on YouTube. There was no indication of where the. I'm not sure. This looks as though it could easily have been shot on a mobile phone or something. No indication of whether this was when it was installed at White Cube or Tate or wherever. You don't get that kind of information often from YouTubers. But it has, in some ways, at the moment, provisionally and perhaps temporarily, provided an archive copy of some description of this work that is accessible. So in a sense, just to kind of wrap up my little presentation now and talk about this in terms of how, you know, this might go forward in terms of a research project. I mean, thinking of the project in terms of using it linked to an equipment resource, as generating the potential for a multiplicity of this kind of nature of research. I mean, mine has been relatively simplistic, I think. I think there's a lot of, but hopefully it's kind of indicated the potential scope for researching across multiple archives in real time and you know, recombining in that way. So it's, you know, potential for the multiplicity of this kind of research to reconfigure the relationships of archives also to practice, to research and to each other. The idea is to explore and create tools for deeper structural relationships, activating perhaps a more kind of performative approach to practice-led research methodology and dissemination. It can be pluralistic and non-hierarchical. It can propose contiguities rather than continuities. It can suggest a reconfiguration of a narrative and structure within a larger matrix of coordinates. We're interested in developing the technology which will open out the potential for the utilisation of metadata, keywords, data analysis and accident to interrogate concurrently a number of archives of different media and generic orientation. So this presentation has been just a little kind of illustration of how I imagine this might work. In producing this, I've had to rely very much on my own kind of preconceived notions, inherent prejudices, but it's possible that, like chance operations, certain hardware and software configurations could be mobilized to make more complex interrogations of multiple archives and collections. This will encourage porousness and recombination. It might even produce a hybrid of archive-based practice-led research with original practice producing new and recombinatory work, which will feed back into the archive itself in very much the way that Vicky Bennett and her People Like Us work is then re-uploaded to the archive that she sourced the material from in the first place. And we're kind of thinking in terms of the potential for this also to be manifested in remote curation and exhibition, aiming, I would say, for an open and adaptable model for the archive, which will be generative, multi-authoritative and non-hegemonic. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very, very much, Steve. There's so much in that that just before Campbell does her presentation, just have a tiny space, not so much for questions, but just to be able to kind of think about what it is that you've said. Because as you were talking, I began to kind of try to write down where I thought that trajectory was going. And just to think about the ways in which if you like, artists' interrogations have shaped imaginatively the kinds of technologies that we're using,
mm-hmm.
and ways in which technologies begin to reshape our own imaginations. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that you're really thinking about how alternative kinds of ways of creating and recreating materials on a speculative and kind of non-functional basis might actually have a dialogue to think about some of the ways in which we practically relate, as people like Pat are really thinking about archives in what we often call the real world. And I think that's a really good starting point for a discussion, because you've just presented us actually almost in a sort of mimetic form with a huge amount of material that's almost based on a kind of orality and vocality. You know, it's like a kind of you talked a lot about language and the ways in which the sort of associations, non-narrative associations actually, of the ways in which we kind of create associations and free associations might really shape how it is that we think as artists about practice-based research. And I think that that's a very, very, very interesting way for us to think, and also quite a complex way for us to think. So it's probably it's going to take quite a long time for that to sink down.
I'm kind of rather hoping that it's hard to know where to begin with, maybe a discussion immediately, but maybe things will kind of filter through the day.
Well, I think one of the ways that we can do that is to kind of think once we've had our next presentation about, if you like, how to curate that discussion, the meeting points that it has with where all of us are kind of coming from, spatially, if you like, and what our own sort of disciplinary backgrounds and sort of stakes are in there. Is that okay?
Can we'll just say something?
Yes, absolutely.
I was actually quite perturbed by that last extract.
Christian Markley?
Not in the way that it was shown. I mean, it brings up the whole thing of copyright, that artists can present their work, they can archive it, and then they have no control over the way it is shown. I thought that was because, as you said, it was probably done covertly with a mobile phone, which is one thing if it's for your own memory purposes, but as soon as it's out there in the public, you have a bastardized form of your own work that if you wanted it out there, you would have put it there in the first place, with it looking good. I speak as someone who's worked with a lot of artists, not just Ian Breakbill, but Bill Viola, swimming pool, by the way.
He's not British, so we didn't have him in the collection, but he's probably on YouTube.
So that, to me, was the most problematic.
I understand, and there's this other thing about found footage,
which I think came in the 60s, when Soho was a thriving centre of the film industry, where you could walk the streets at night and find footage that had been thrown out.
Yeah.
Now I think by found footage you mean appropriated footage rather than found footage.
But there's a delicious thing, Felicity, that Christine Barclay ripped off all those images
herself.
So,
where is the copyright?
Okay, so the copyright isn't there, but there's still, if you're an artist, and I think I speak for a lot of artists are, not just Ian, nervous about putting their work into a film archive as opposed to an art archive, is that you have no control over the way, you know, you've worked very hard to make your installation, you know, and it's probably a lot of expense, you know, researching the right technology to present it. To have it then shown out, Steve McQueen is a very good example. To then have it shown in a way that is not the way that you wanted it shown. I'm just throwing this up.
It's a good point of discussion. Yeah.
It might actually be, in a way, an entry point into Campbell's presentation, because without wanting you to respond to that, because I think that those questions about authority and anxiety, and if you like, where the work sits at an intersection between present and past, and really what both the responsibilities and opportunities are for artists, and the emotional investment suggests the importance of the dialogue that archivists and artists have got to have, doesn't it? And also that there are real stakes at play, not just virtual stakes or fun, but many, many other kinds of ways in which we need to think about it. So, I mean, two ways to go forward. Are there either to start to kind of list at this point some of those points for discussion, or to just take that snapshot point of Felicity's, take Campbell's presentation and kind of come back to it? Because
it was an emotional response, it wasn't in any way a thought-through response. It was that's how I felt when I was watching it.
So it's an important and valid response. So it's not like it's without context.
I think it kind of illustrates a point that we are at the moment in terms of the relationship between the artist as individual producer and the network and as distributed exhibition space, if you like, or archive, or whatever you want to call it in this sense. And then thinking also about, I mean, people like, going back to Vicky Bennett and people like us, I mean, she's very much an advocate for the whole Creative Commons copyright license project, which in a sense mitigates almost entirely against the notion of the individual artist as prime producer and copyright holder and owner of the work and so on and so forth, and to a much more distributed notion, which is kind of grappling with the real world issues of what happens when so much is available, you know, virtually freely and so on. So, you know, I think that we're at a point in the development of these things where there are these sort of one notion of what is cultural and artistic production is coming up against the new kind of network notion. And I think it's also, you know, you also see examples of it in the relationship, say, between distribution and edition collections in galleries and so on, especially in terms of moving image work. So, and it's an interesting point to talk around, I think, as well. I mean, I just to kind of clarify one thing that I would be thinking about in terms of this. I mean, we're at the very, very early stages of, thinking about this as a kind of potential research project area. But in terms of that, I would be thinking in terms of work that is, artists' work that is for research purposes within the institution. I wouldn't, at this stage, certainly, without having to,
encounter a whole lot of rights management issues. I wouldn't think of sort of putting this out into the world. This happens very much within the institutional context of academic research, and anything that goes out into the world or out onto the web is subject to the normal kind of copyright agreements. So, I mean, I think in those terms, YouTube and the way that people are doing stuff like that, by wandering around with their mobile phones and then putting it on YouTube, I mean, in a sense, that's what has developed, and it's kind of very difficult to, if not impossible, to kind of control that uses. And it's how we deal with that, I guess, is something that comes up.
One of the things we might want to return to in terms of, you know, the fact that we're in a university might be what kind of space research opens up for us to experiment and have dialogue with sometimes quite contentious and difficult ideas.
Yeah.
And I'd like to invite Campbell to talk about Lux Online at that point, and then we'll enter into further discussion. Thank you very much.
Can I just request that we have
two-minute break? Oh, of course. Never do that. Then while Campbell actually...
I wish you'd said that before.